Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up a little bit later in the show, Adam Conover from True TV's Adam Ruins Everything will be with us. Talk about his big show he's got coming up at the Park West next week. It's sort of a election Adam Ruins Everything, election themed. Also, musician Rachel Yamagata is going to join us. She has Chicago roots. She played in a band called Bumpus here for a long time. And she has got a new record out, Tightrope Walker. We'll talk about her show coming up at Talia Hall as well. Well, when you think of musicians from Chicago, you think, well, Kanye West, Smashing Pumpkins, perhaps. Maybe the band Chicago. But none of those artists come close to the visionary that was Curtis Mayfield.
Just move on up toward your destination. Though you may find from time to time complications.
From the Impressions to an impressive solo career, Curtis Mayfield was a driving force in music, both the sound and the movement. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame musician died in 1999 after living as a quadriplegic after a freak stage accident. He was survived by members of the Impressions, producers, and, of course, his family. His son, Todd Mayfield, has written his father's story in the new book, Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. In the book, he talks about his dad's early days on the South Side, to his family's move to Cabrini-Green, to the early days of doo-wop, to providing the soundtrack to the civil rights movement. And it is my pleasure to welcome Todd Mayfield to The Download. Thanks for being here, Todd.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
I feel like I've lived a lot of your life by reading this book today. I am immersed in your story. Let's start. I mean, you mentioned in the book, you say there have been biographies about Curtis Mayfield. There have been a couple to this point, but none of them were able to really hit it on the mark because they didn't really include his private life.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that's really what I think people are going to find the most interesting, in addition to, you know, all the music that he's produced and written and performed. I think people really didn't know who he was as an individual, partly because he was pretty private about his private life, and we as his family kind of, you know, kept in that line. And so I think people will find it really interesting.
What did you have to do? I mean, you obviously have stories and you were, you know, you lived life with your dad and for good and bad. But what did you have to do to write this biography? I mean, you talked to a lot of different people he worked with, including other family members as well.
Yes, there was a ton of research that we had to do. My collaborator, Travis Atria, did a wonderful job at just being very detail-oriented in his research and just uncovering all sorts of things that I didn't know in different interviews and what have you. So it really came together when we collaborated and then adding the research and then the personal interviews that we did with family members, business associates, other artists that he performed with and that he worked that worked for him. So it all came together pretty well, and we're happy with the results.
I mean, for you as you know, as the son, I mean, when you're there's a lot of stories in this book you didn't know about, right?
Yeah,
talk about that. I mean, talk about the experience of reliving your life. I mean, your relationship with your dad through interviews and putting together a book.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, some of the more surprising things early on came with the family research. You know, I knew we came from Louisiana, and my great-grandmother, who had a church called Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church, she was a heavy influence on him. I didn't know that our name could have possibly been Cooper instead of Mayfield when she changed their names. After she moved to Chicago and began a relationship with a man with last name Mayfield. So things like that. You know, I kind of start off the book. I won't tell everything, but Jerry
got the
Butler,
whole hour, Todd.
Yeah, Jerry Butler gave us a few stories from early on and about how cool my dad was in the face of, you know, wise guys and other, you know, promoters who may want to rip him off. And,
right.
You know, but he always was steadfast in getting his money. So So those were pretty cool.
Well,
stories
I mean,
as
one
well.
Of one of the great things about the book and the story of your dad was the fact that, I mean, his career was the quintessential, you know, sort of music to make it kind of career, where
right.
not everything that he did, it's not like they handed him a guitar when he was 5 years old and he's like, oh, he's on the stage, he's the most successful guitarist of all time. I mean,
right.
he worked it through. I mean, there was this grind that goes through records that he put out that didn't work well, or, you know, combinations of band members that didn't work out. And,
right.
you know, so many things throughout his illustrious career that didn't necessarily go his way, but he was a grinder. He pushed through. I mean, he kept on pushing, if you will.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he's totally self-taught in more ways than one, not only musically, but business-wise, and he just had a vision. And again, I think a lot of that goes back to my great-grandmother Annabelle, who was, you know, like I said, a spiritualist and had her own church, and then she had the kids, you know, form a choir, and so they, you know, they kind of traveled around and, mm-hmm. and did friendly competitions with other spiritualist churches from around the country. So all of that, I think, was very influential on him.
Why don't we start there with Annie Bell? I mean, that sort of was the a character in the book that really at an early age for Curtis really sort of, you know, got him interested in music and gospel music and all
right.
things, but also got him into music. But he's even said in interviews that, you know, this was the person who was the influence on his life. This was the father figure, if you will, the person that he looked up to the most.
Right. Yeah. So she came up from a tiny town called Mansfield, Louisiana, part of the Great Northern Migration. And she brought with her, when she came up to Chicago, the spiritualism, and where she believed, and she others believed that she could speak to people who were dead, and that
right.
she could actually communicate with them, and then, you know, and then communicate what their thoughts and wishes were to their relatives and things like that. So she actually ended up having quite a decent following, and that made her relatively prosperous for that time. And I think my dad saw that. I mean, because his family was very poor. I mean, sometimes they couldn't even have, you know, anything to eat for dinner. They'd have
right.
water for dinner.
Right.
But through her church, my great-grandmother Annabelle, she was able to live a relatively prosperous life and, you know, and had all the basics covered, food, shelter, and relative comfort for that time.
And they lived in the South Side, and we talked about the different places that Curtis Mayfield has lived in his life. But there was an attraction to gospel music. That really was the roots, the start, obviously through his grandmother, your great-grandmother. But really, that was the foundation of Curtis Mayfield's music.
Absolutely. It was definitely rooted in the church and in gospel. And then, you know, a lot of times to make a song secular, you would just substitute something else for God.
Right.
You know, it could be a woman or a person or whatever you were talking about. You just kind of make a substitution instead of having God in there, and it's a secular song.
We're talking with Todd Mayfield. He's the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield, his father. He's got a book launch party coming up at Promontory on 5311 South Lake Park. It's going to be on October 1st at 3:00. We'll talk more. Let's take a quick break.
Great.
And when we come back, let's talk about the early days of doo-wop and the forming of the Impressions. I mean, that story is one that Chicago knows a lot about, because they really do hold dear the Impressions and a lot of the doo-wop bands that came out of here. We'll talk about how that got started and catapulting the fame with Curtis Mayfield. Todd Mayfield, my guest, his son. Stay with us.
Keep on. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow.
It's hard to cut that song off, Todd, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
All of the stuff from The Impressions. The Life of Curtis Mayfield, the book Traveling Soul. We're talking to Todd Mayfield, Curtis Mayfield's son. He's written the definitive biography. The book launch party will be on October 1st at Promontory in Hyde Park. It's at 3:00. Todd, you know, we left talking about doo-wop in the beginning of Curtis Mayfield's career in doo-wop, and it really started when he moved to Cabrini Green and started rehearsing in Seward Park and
right.
some of the places. And this was the beginning days, if not the beginning, of the housing project.
Yeah, it was the beginning. I believe that they were the first family to move in the row house where they lived on Hudson, right off of Chicago Avenue, and which is an honorary Curtis Mayfield Street now. I don't know how long that's going to last since that area is turning over so much.
And no, those
will probably be gone soon.
But. Hey, the houses may be gone, but that street stays, yeah, Curtis Mayfield Street.
I hope so.
I'll help you.
I hope
okay,
so.
we'll yeah. protect that.
So back then, I mean, that's just what a lot of young people did. I mean, they practiced, you know, and they sang on the corner instead of doing other things like they do on the corners these days. But it was all friendly. It was all a bunch of camaraderie. They had, you know, competition to see who could get the most people to stand outside of their practice hall to, you know, to kind of peer in and see who's actually, you know, making that music and creating that sound. So that was, you know, it wasn't only in Cabrini Green, but it was all over Chicago, over the country. I would think in a lot of urban areas where a lot of kids got together and they, you know, formed singing groups and what have you.
The Impressions obviously came shortly thereafter. The Roosters was the original name, and then changed the Impressions. But talk about that, because it's Jerry Butler, it's Curtis Mayfield, the others in the group. I mean, this was the start of something, a friendship and a chemistry that lasted for decades.
Right.
Talk about your dad getting together with these gentlemen and the beginnings of the doo-wop sort of explosion out of Chicago.
Right. Well, Jerry and my father actually met at my great-grandmother's church. Jerry, his family was a member there, and so Jerry and my dad met there, and they sang within the church's choir. At that time,
would this been like the early 50s?
That would be probably around 50, 52 ish, you know, maybe 53. And so even back then, my dad started trying to teach himself to play the guitar, and he also had a little small group of younger kids, and Jerry was working with some other older guys, Arthur and Richard Brooks and a guy named Sam Good, and all out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so they were the Roosters, and Jerry recruited my dad to join their group because he wanted to actually have someone with a tenor voice and also who could play an instrument.
Right, right. And your dad played a very specific style of guitar.
Right.
Self-taught, which is
self-taught.
Amazing to think about how
F-sharp.
Prolific he was as a guitar player throughout his career, but it was self-taught, and he added something that a lot of groups didn't have.
Right. His sound was distinctive because it was tuned to F-sharp, which is not standard tuning. F-sharp is all the black keys on the piano. So he didn't know that was wrong. So he just did it and ran with it, you know, and just had that distinctive sound.
What came next was, you know, a great sort of lesson in how, you know, R&B and doo-wop and sort of rhythm and blues took off here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So many bands that were here were getting signed. There's VJ Records,
right.
Other record companies, Chess Records, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But talk about that time, because that's really when, you know, your dad and others started to be able to get airplay, to be able to record records and get a career started.
Right. Well, they were performing at a talent show, Washburn Community Talent Show, and that's where they were, for lack of a better word, discovered by Eddie Thomas, who was a little bit older also, but he managed other groups, and he was just kind of a hustler guy that would just, you know, kind of help move things forward.
There's a great image in the book where he's got the Cadillac, and he's the guy you want to talk to.
Yeah, because he, you know, he was really good at talking and building relationships and kind of moving the ball forward and helping organize and coming up with a vision.
And played a huge role in your dad's career.
Yeah, absolutely.
Years later, but continue.
Absolutely. So Eddie met them at the talent show and then decided to work with them. He liked what they were doing. He hated the name, you know, Roosters. You know, people would start crowing and everything like that when they'd be on stage sometimes, you know. And so he suggested that they change their name, and so they finally came up with the Impressions.
And the Impressions, I mean, to skip just for time, I mean, obviously putting out record after record,
right,
and touring off those records, but it really, I mean, there's so many, What was the song? Precious Love?
Is for Your Precious Love.
Your Precious Love.
That was the
love.
First hit that they recorded.
And that really is what broke them in the way that now everyone was paying attention to. They loved it. They were able to tour off of this. And when we talk about tour, I mean, it is a grind. We're talking city to city. Not the greatest travel arrangements. This is not rock and roll.
Circuit.
Right. Talk about that. But that was a huge break. But at the same time, it wasn't like your dad was rolling in it because he had a hit record.
No. First of all, I mean, you're splitting it five ways with the group, and you're young, so it probably wasn't that great of a contract. It was your first deal, so you probably weren't making a whole lot of money off of it either way. But it did give him a chance to tour and what he would call woodshed and practice his craft and get comfortable out there on bigger stages and bigger venues.
Right.
And ultimately, they played the Apollo, which was probably his biggest. Concert at that point when, you know, he was all, I think, 16 years old.
There's a great story right there where they decided they wanted to play something that maybe from Elvis Presley.
Right.
And the audience was like, no.
Right.
They were introduced to an audience that was not necessarily friendly for the first time in their career.
Exactly. So they had to learn how to adapt and deal with, pleasing their audience instead of just, playing standards, which I think they were trying to play a couple of those, songs that the folks in Harlem weren't too excited about.
Todd Mayfield is my guest tonight. He's the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. Curtis Mayfield, of course, his father. He's going to have a book launch party on October 1st down at Promontory. It's at 3 o'clock, Promontory in Hyde Park, the great restaurant, 5311 South Lake Park. All right, so let's take a quick break. We'll take a break for the news. When we come back. There's so much to talk about. I could talk to you for 3 hours just on the doo-wop stuff alone. But, I mean, we'll talk about, the decision to go solo and what came of your dad's life, when he became a huge star and it really became the soundtrack for the civil rights movement here in this country. We're talking with Todd Mayfield here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. My guest at the big table, Todd Mayfield, is the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield, who is his father. He's going to have a book launch party down at the Promontory on Saturday the 1st, right? The Saturday the 1st?
Yeah,
right? Already?
Saturday the 1st. Yeah. Time flies.
I know, right? The Promontory at 3 o'clock. We left off talking about the doo-wop scene. The impressions, they just took off. I mean, if you think about the mid to late 60s, the Impressions had so many hits. I mean, everything from Keep On Pushing, People Get Ready, We're Winners. I mean, it's just crazy how many songs when you're going through the Impressions catalog that were just smash hits that stand the test of time. Talk about what your dad was going through as it went from struggles and playing the Chitlin Circuit to, crossing over into a place where the music was becoming larger than life.
Well, I think as time went on, he became more confident in what he was doing. Again, he was always looking at what was going on in the world around him and taking that in and processing it and putting out a message of inspiration for the masses. And so with more success, I think he began to feel like there were things that he wanted to say and express that maybe the Impressions, because of their track record and their history of being kind of like giving folks food for thought, I think that he kind of wanted to get a little bit more edgy and a little more personal about
the music, because it was a doo-wop band.
Right.
And you're seeing in the 60s and even turning into the 70s, much more of a funk kind of guitar, a lot of going on there
The movement was kind of changing as well, too, at that time, because obviously Martin Luther King was assassinated. And then you kind of had a little bit of the Black Power with the Black Panthers and other actors coming in. So I think he, began to get a little bit more edgier and kind of focusing more on what folks were feeling in the streets and in the community.
I want to take back to the idea of the Chicago sound. Mm-hmm. You know, there, you dedicate a little part about the Chicago sound and what that was when it comes to R&B, when it comes to music in general. What was the Chicago sound that your dad sort of became the pioneer, the champion of?
Well, I think it kind of started not only with himself, but Carl Davis, who was a record producer.
Yeah.
And then also a gentleman named Johnny Pate, who was a magnificent arranger, who basically wrote a lot of the horn lines per my dad's dictations, because my dad could not read or write music, oddly enough, which
that's
is
crazy.
Pretty amazing.
That's crazy
to be able to write all this music, and you don't have a formal education in music, so you can't read and write it. So you just have to dictate what's the sounds that are coming out of your head to someone who can transcribe it. So you know, Carl Davis, Johnny Pate, my father, they, you know, created, I think, the Chicago sound. And my dad worked for Carl Davis very often, because Carl Davis had his own label. I think it was called OK Records. And so my dad would produce, write and produce for a lot of his acts and artists. And so that's kind of how it became.
You know, the other thing we mentioned early on is your dad with the Impressions, even before that, with the gospel music, and even after that, he lived a life on the road. I mean, he was someone who seemed to be very comfortable with the way that musicians had to tour, but it also took an emotional, mental toll on him, in the sense that, you know, it was night after night, and a lot of times, as we mentioned, it wasn't necessarily the best accommodations,
right,
and transportation. But talk about that, because the book is called Traveling Soul. There is something about your dad and the road that are sort of synonymous.
Right. Well, the road is a necessary evil. You know, you got to get out there and promote the records. And touring is actually a huge source of income for recording artists, because oftentimes, again, you know, the recording contract itself isn't extremely lucrative. Even if you do, if you are fortunate enough to get a hit, you may not get a whole lot of money just from the recording contract. So, but what making a record would allow you to do is to go out and tour, and that, you know, that gives you the ability to make a decent living.
And the other thing too is that he did have the ability by touring to have his sort of finger on the pulse, if not on how to make a hit record, because that was something you talk about in the book, but just what was happening in this country when it came to the movements and to the civil rights movement and other things, that he was there with the crowds and the audience, and he would understand what was happening. So it made it easier for him to write these anthems, write these songs that became the soundtrack for a movement.
Right. And oftentimes he would talk about how respectful the audiences were after a period of time where he was writing these more socially conscious songs. And the people would get quiet in there and really, like, listen to what they're doing, and then they'd go crazy after the song is over. But it was kind of that dynamic oftentimes with between the group and the audience.
You know, let's talk about his transition from the Impressions to a solo record. I mean, that was a difficult move for him, obviously, leaving the Impressions he'd been with for decades to embark on a solo career. That was tough for him, the idea of, because Fred and was Sam. I mean, entire lives together. They were almost kids that came up together. They made decisions. They performed music. They toured together. There was they were really considered family.
Yeah, they were like brothers. Right. And so, but one good thing about it was that, you know, he just started his own label, the Kurt Tom label, with himself, Kurt and Eddie Thomas Tom. So that gave them two acts to start with, right? So you had the Impressions, and they inserted a gentleman named Leroy Hudson to take over the lead. And my dad still did a lot of their writing and producing. But, you know, then they had two acts, and he started his solo career and with the Curtis album, which was a big hit. And
that record, I mean, that's the one that everyone will know. I mean, Curtis Mayfield, your dad has lived a lot of different lives. He lived, you know, as the Impressions and doo-wop. People remember that time. But the solo records, Curtis, and even the soundtrack to Superfly. Mm-hmm. But there was a style. I mean, the Hell Below, Move On Up, as we heard in the earlier in the thing. This was a different style of music.
Yeah,
a music
sound,
that a lot
totally
of people hadn't heard before. Talk about where that came from. What moved him to move in this direction when it comes to this music?
Well, again, I just think it was a changing times. I mean, you know, the civil rights movement was kind of petering out, and, you know, the philosophy of the nonviolence was turning to more of a black power and we're not going to turn the other cheek type of sentiment. And so the whole nation was just getting a little bit more edgy. The sounds were, you know, becoming really funky, you know, with a lot of bass and still a lot of orchestration from the strings, but it was just a lot more edgy and funkier.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, this, you know, I don't know if what the answer is, but I mean, you were born in what, 66?
Yes.
So this was all going down, 71, 72, even 73 was a Superfly soundtrack.
Superfly was 72, 73,
yeah.
Right?
What are the memories of that time? I mean, not from the research, but do you have any memories of your childhood of being the son of Curtis when all this was going down?
Yeah. Well, you know, we definitely used to tour whenever we could to do short hops. Like if he's performing in Milwaukee or somewhere in the Midwest, you know, we run out there with him and stuff like that. And a lot of times it's boring for kids, you know, the image may be like, wow, you're going to this concert, you're backstage, but oftentimes I'd be back in the back sleep or, you know, we're playing chess or something like that, just kind of waiting for the show to happen. And, but yeah, I definitely remember those times. And I absolutely remember when he was scoring the film Superfly, because he had a really huge contraption of a video tape recorder, that had the film, and then it had a time sync at the bottom. So he's always like, you know, trying to figure out where he wants to cue the music and stuff like that. So I was only like around 6 years old, but I still remember that vividly.
And you mentioned, you know, there's something amazing for music lovers and for people who were into your dad's music to be in the room when he's, you know, working on Superfly, the soundtrack, which became such a huge hit. But for a six-year-old kid, it's not as glamorous to watch a musician work out a song than the actual finished product.
No, it's like, you know, come on, Dad, let's go play some basketball. He's like, I can't do that right now.
Talking with Todd Mayfield. He's the son of Curtis Mayfield. He wrote the book Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll wrap it up. I want to talk to you about, you know, the waning days of his life.
Sure.
I mean, the accident, which happened in 1990, was
yes.
that right? So he lived 9 years after that. We don't have to get into detail about, but, you know, the lighting rig falls on him in a bad storm in a concert. And he's essentially confined to a wheelchair and to a bed for the rest of his life.
Yes.
He'll still be able to make music, things of that nature. But we'll talk about that, because you entered his life at that time, even before that, and re-entered and had a great relationship with him. So we'll talk about your relationship with your dad, Curtis Mayfield. When we return, stay with us. We've only got like 8 minutes left, which is killing me here, Todd. I got to say, the book is so great, and it's a great story of such an influential man, especially Chicago, and it's really great that Chicago plays such a role in this book from the early days of his life to even where the Kurtom Records was, 5915 North Lincoln Avenue,
right
here in Chicago. The book is called Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. It's written by his son, Todd Mayfield, who's my guest tonight at the big table. It's going to be at the Promontory on Saturday for a book launch party, 3 o'clock. You know, let's talk about your life. I mean, obviously being around your father, a texter just texted in saying, you know, could you ask Todd what he knows about working with his dad when he worked on the record with Gladys Knight.
Right.
And, you know, just when I mentioned that to you, your face lit up, because in the book, you know, you talk about you being an eight-year-old kid and loving Gladys Knight. Talk about that experience, but also just the idea of being around this movement as such a young kid.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was always just what we knew. You know, people ask all the time, you know, what was it like growing up in that household and with a father like that? It's normal to us, because that's all we knew, you know. But, you know, we did get a chance to spend a lot of time with him. And often when we were with him, we would be in the studio. And he's producing various people. And I definitely remember being in the control room while he's producing Gladys Knight and the Pips for the Claudine soundtrack, which was an amazing soundtrack and a really great film, too, with James Earl Jones and Diana Carroll. And, you know, one of my most vivid memories is that I just loved Gladys Knight. I just thought, you know, she was the greatest woman around, you know. And, of course, she, you know, would be nice to me and, you know, that sort of thing. So that was a lot of fun to be around that. And we were able to, as kids, my brothers and sisters, my brothers and sister, able to be in the recording studio with them a lot.
How hard was it? I mean, you talk about some of the pros and the cons. You know, yeah. So what I do like about this book is that, you know, you talk about your relationship with your father, but you also talk about some of the demons that he had in his life.
Right.
Drug use, some other things, you know, that he had with bad relationships and things of that nature.
Yes.
What was it like for you as a son to have a father who was not only famous but on the road? Meaning, you know, for Traveling Souls, the name of the book, but
right.
he was gone for a lot of his life. When he needed to make money and go out on the road, he was gone, and there were a lot of times you didn't see him.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, even when I was born, I mean, he wasn't back home for over a week, almost 2 weeks. So it was difficult on my mother. And as I mentioned in the book, it was almost like, you know, he was an absent father, but he wasn't absent. You know, he was definitely in our lives, but sometimes it was like both ways, because he would be on tour or just not, you know, be available as a lot of other families are or fathers
sure.
are when they have a regular old 9-to-5. You know, they're going to be home at 5:30 and, you know, they're going to eat the meal and hang out, go to bed, and then do it all over again. So it wasn't exactly like that. But at the same time, like I said, that's all we knew. So it was our normal. And, you know, I don't think we were any worse off for it in the end.
Well, your family wasn't divorced, because your mom and your dad didn't get divorced, but they split at a certain point. He had
right.
two houses, so you would be at his house at certain points. And you
right.
talk about towards the end, especially as things kind of, you know, as a career kind of dwindles towards the end, which is hard to believe. I mean, there's some stuff in here I'm like, I can't believe all the music he put out
right.
after the hits that we all know, just trying to strike another hit.
Yeah.
But being around that, he was, you know, and you talk about this, he was someone who was a private individual, and he spent a lot of time by himself. And even when you guys would be over, he'd shut the door and go in the room, and he would be all by himself. And
right.
and what kind of toll that took on you as a family? I mean, there was a point where you were resentful about sort of that idea.
Yeah, well, you know, all that most kids ever want from their parents is to spend time with them, you know, just to do little mundane things, or just to do nothing, just hang out, just like I do with my 8-year-old. I just know she just wants me to be around, you know. And that's, you know, that's one thing that you miss sometimes, but you just deal with it. It's because, you know, there are so many other things that he did that were really good, and so you have to take the good with the bad sometimes. But overall, and I, you know, he definitely showed that he loved us, and I think that was something that overrode everything else, you know, the good and the bad. But so you know that there was love there, and he was actually very nurturing, and, you know, will teach you a lot of life lessons.
You know, some of your family got in the business pretty quick with your dad. You were one who went to college, you know, did your own thing. But after college, you show back up, and you reconnected with your dad, and you had an adult relationship touring with him
right.
and being a part of the business. What did that mean to you to have that the relationship with your dad at that stage of your life?
Oh, that was very important. I mean, I always, and we talked about this when, you know, when I was a kid, that, you know, at some point we'd work together, you know, I'd help him run his business. And it was really fulfilling when I finally got a chance to do that. It wasn't under the best circumstances, obviously, because he had a catastrophic injury. But I felt that I was able to step up and make significant contributions to the well-being of the family from a financial standpoint, and just for a stability from a stability perspective. So
let me ask you this as we wrap up. I mean, you know, not everybody gets a chance to write a book about their dad. You know, I'd love to write a book about it. Even reading this, I was like, oh man, that would be an emotional experience. How emotional was it for you to go back into some of these stories, to think about your life in the 60s, the 70s, even your adult life as you were, you know, with your dad after the accident? How difficult was it for you to, and emotional was it for you to write this?
It was emotional at times, because you're reliving, you know, painful moments, and it was great at some points because you're reliving joyful moments. So it was a mixed bag. But and then, you know, you have other family members who are kind of anxious about what you're going to say. You know,
yeah,
are you going
right.
to tell too much, or, you know, what are you going to do? So there was a little bit of that we had to work through as well, and had to make sure that everyone was comfortable with what I was doing, and, you know, so they would support it, because I couldn't have done it without my family members.
It's amazing to think about your dad and the story, and to get even deeper when he was a kid and made fun of, and some because of his appearance, and how he kept that for his life, and then just the emotional experiences of him going on stage and being able to find self-worth in that experience. I mean, there's so many life lessons that come out of this. For you, what do you take away from this after doing this project and also as someone who lived it? What's your takeaway about your dad's life?
Well, I think overall, you know, he was just a person who found himself at a very early age, and he knew that that's what he wanted to do. Most people don't experience that, you know, they kind of flail around and, you know, figure it out later. But he found himself at a very early age, and so it's basically like, if, you know, this is what you love, then that's what you do. You work towards it, and then go for your dreams and your aspirations. I mean, I think the only job he ever had was when he was maybe 14 years old. He sold Dunhill cigars, right? You know, door to door downtown here in the Loop. And so, you know, and another amazing thing is that I wouldn't obviously not recommend the kids, but, you know, he dropped out of school in ninth grade. So this was it. It was like, it's going to happen, or it's just going to be, I don't know what's going to be. But, you know, he made it happen in a big way.
Todd Mayfield, the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. Obviously, Todd Mayfield, Curtis Mayfield's son. You know, for your daughter, your eight-year-old daughter, I mean, are you telling the story of her grandfather?
Oh, yeah. She knows who Grandpa Curtis is. Does. She can hear a record on the radio, and she knows that's him.
No way.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, we don't even have time to talk about how hip-hop, I mean, you could make a strong argument, and I could spend 30 minutes talking about how Curtis and the music of his time, and specifically him, inspired and developed hip-hop as we know it. I mean, you think of all the tracks that he did throughout the 70s are tracks that everyone is using now.
Right.
It's pretty it's intense if you really look at it.
Yeah, the list of hip-hop artists and just other, you know, pop artists and everyone who's covered his music or sampled his music is quite impressive. So
Todd Mayfield, my guest, he's going to have a book launch party at the Promontory down on 5311 South Lake Park Avenue. He will be there on Saturday at 3 o'clock. Todd Mayfield, my pleasure to have you here on The Download. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Justin.